look at Psalm 3 to start, because David writes this psalm as he's a fleeing from Absalom. So this is relevant. So I got this question. I think Luther Kramshire asked me this last week. Is there any psalms that are related to this next passage? The answer is absolutely yes. In fact, it's the third psalm. And so I want you to see this. Now, with the psalms, there's a sort of pattern. And now, it's not always true, but it's a rough pattern in the way the psalms were arranged. All the psalms were written at different times. And so it was later that the scribes and the rabbis and the temple worshipers kind of compiled the psalms, of which there are 150. 151, you will find in Orthodox Bible, there's an extra really small psalm. Doesn't really change anything doctrinally. It's interesting. But almost all Bibles have, yep, there he is. I see Alex admitting him. I just admitted him. All right. So anyway, yeah, exactly. He's in the breakout session or something. But in the Psalms, what they did is they arranged them in a certain pattern. So the first Psalm is a wisdom Psalm. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. That's a wisdom Psalm. The second Psalm is messianic and more cosmic. Right. The second psalm is about the God saying to his anointed one, right, that sort of thing. And God laughs at his enemies. That's the second one. The third psalm is a plea for help. And so generally, these sort of three psalms, it starts off with these three to kind of frame the rest of the others. That's generally how it's portrayed. And so the provenance of this psalm is when David's fleeing from Absalom. However, since we try to find Christ behind every rock and tree, we can also see this psalm on the lips of Christ. So it's a both and, not an either or, like all the time in scripture. So let's look at Psalm 3. This is an awesome, I mean, all the Psalms are awesome, but I've told you before, I think it was last semester, that if I struggle with prayer, I pray the Psalms because, you know, my brain works too fast and I'm my own worst enemy and I'm thinking all these extra thoughts. And so I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to use the Psalms. And that calms my mind and allows, and the Psalms have everything. Luther says the Psalms are like a mini Bible unto themselves, right? Because they have everything. All right, so here we go. Psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. Here we go. O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I awoke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people. That's it. So obviously he's in a hurry, right? Not much more to say when you're on the run from Absalom and hiding in caves and doing everything else that he's doing, creating a military strategy. But Absalom's rebellion here leads to a sort of civil war of sorts. And so here's David, and this is what he's saying, because some of this is David's own fault. And yet, David, in the midst of his suffering, in the midst of running, writes this psalm. And now, again, on the lips of Christ, or a little application, a little beginning devotional before this long historical narrative. Of course, think of this of Christ when he's abandoned by the apostles. It's Holy Week, right? Oh, Lord, how many are my foes, right? Many are saying salvation. There's no salvation for him in God. He's being taunted on the cross, right? You can see this on the lips of Christ. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, right? He answered me. I lay down and slept, and I awoke again. Jesus dies. He's resurrected. So we can look at these sort of things, like every believer that dies is a mini resurrection. And so in this case, in Christ, it's the literal resurrection. Arise, O Lord, and save me. You strike all my enemies. And of course, the ultimate enemy is defeated on the cross, and salvation truly does belong to the Lord. It doesn't belong to any human being. It belongs to God himself. And so you can see this on the lips of Christ going through his passion as far as this goes. And so it's a both and. It's both David and then 1,000 years through history in Christ. So just know that if you wanted that, and most of your study Bibles will have this, Psalm 3 is the psalm that we point to during these events of 2 Samuel 15 through 19. And so as a warning, this is one of those passages where, again, there's not a lot of application. It's a historical narrative. And so we just kind of got to get through this. And it really is a drama. It would make a good movie, to be honest. There's, you know, backstabbing, and there's war, and there's, you know, there's lust, and there's evil, and there's good, and there's victory, and there's loss and suffering, and it would make a great movie, to be honest. And so that's kind of what this is, what we're going to see here with the rebellion of Absalom. So it starts in 2 Samuel 15 to recap where we were, because basically starting in 2 Samuel 11, 10 or 11, we have this long continuous narrative about David's failings. And so it starts with David and Bathsheba, which we spent a good amount of time on. And then there's the rape of Tamar, right? We have Absalom and Amnon. Absalom gets revenge and basically extrajudicially, as a vigilante, kills his half-brother in revenge, and then goes out and he goes into exile with his granddaddy at a neighboring kingdom. Eventually, David welcomes him home, but he doesn't recognize him in the court. Eventually, Joab and Absalom kind of have it out because Absalom lights Joab's fields on fire to get Joab's attention. And eventually, David actually kisses Absalom, his son, in court, which in this culture is an official welcoming back because it's in front of everybody, right? And so by saying this, Absalom has been restored. So Absalom's been restored. David is kind of knows there's some issues here, but is also ignorant of what's really in Absalom's heart and what he's going to try to accomplish. And that's the action as it picks up here in 2 Samuel 15. Okay. So here we go. Here's the conspiracy. So 2 Samuel 15. After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses, 50 men to run before him. Now, this is not an army. This is just kind of like a parade. Okay. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there is no man designated by the king to hear you." Then Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were judge in the land, that every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice." And whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. Thus Absalom did to all Israel who came to the king for judgment. And so Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Okay, I'm going to make this easy for you. Absalom's being a politician. He's making promises and he's pressing flesh. He's shaking hands. So he's going to everybody, right? It's like a campaign event. So instead of letting people go to the king for judgment, he's intercepting them and saying, "Hey, look, I know you're on your way to see the king right now, but I've got a better plan." See, this is, he's campaigning. He's campaigning. He's pressing flesh, right, in the Middle Eastern way. So he's kissing them, that sort of thing. That's the whole kiss on each cheek. That's how they greeted each other back then, right? And they still do in certain parts of the Middle East. You've seen that with Jewish people or Arab people. And so he's doing this, but he's pressing flesh. This is a political campaign. He's winning them over. He's changing public sentiment. He's trying to raise his approval ratings in the polls. And it's working. Okay, so that's my 21st century. It'd be like the vice president or, you know, somebody in the cabinet running against the president. That's kind of what this is. Okay, here we go. At the end of the 4 years, so he does this for 4 years, which is kind of funny too, because our presidential campaigns are every 4 years, right? At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron." Okay, now already David should be suspicious, but he doesn't seem to be. Here's why. In the Old Testament, if you read through Deuteronomy and Leviticus, and it talks about paying vows, you're supposed to do it right away. So for him to have gone to exile and then wait another 4 years. Now, David's a pious man. David respects vows made unto God, so he lets him go. But this already is a little suspicious, just letting you know, okay? "For your servant vowed a vow while I lived at Geshur in Aram." Geshur in Aram is his granddad's place, saying, "If the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I'll offer worship to the Lord." The king said to him, "Go in peace." So he arose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent secret messengers throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, say then, Absalom is king at Hebron." When Absalom went, 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests, and they went in their innocence and knew nothing. And while Absalom was offering sacrifices, he sent for, this is a fun name, Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city in Gilo. And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. And so he's planned this whole thing out. He's had 4 years to plot it. And so now there's a signal to the rest of, you remember, this is before texting. This is before the internet. This is before tweets, right? Right now, all you do is send a group text. Okay. So his group text in this case is a trumpet call. That's the group text. When you hear the trumpet call, it's time for action. So that's his version of a group text. That's why I translate that for my students. It's funny because they actually kind of, I was like, that makes sense, you know? And I'm like, okay. I guess it's working. And a messenger came to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel had gone after Absalom," right? So this is like, you've read the public opinion polls, but in this case, we're actually seeing it now. There's actually a small army and just followers that are all gathering at Hebron around Absalom. Then David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go quickly, lest you overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. And the king's servant said to the king, behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king decides. So the king went out and all his household after him. And the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. And the king went out and all the people after him, and they halted at the last house. And all his servants passed by him, and all the Kerethites and all the Pelethites and all the 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath passed on before the king. These are David's mighty men. This is like his inner army, his like personal bodyguard and such. And then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, why do you also go down with us? Go back and stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home. You came only yesterday, and shall I today make you wander about with us? Since I go, I know not where. Go back and take your brothers with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you. But Ittai answered the king, as the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be. Almost sounds like Ruth and Naomi a little bit, if you know that story, right? Your God will be my God. It's very much like that. And David said to Ittai, go then, pass on. So Ittai the Gittite passed on with all his men and all the little ones who were with him. And all the land wept aloud as all the people passed by. And the king crossed the brook of Kidron, and the people passed on towards the wilderness. The Kidron Brook is right outside of Jerusalem, the Kidron Valley. And so they're crossing the Kidron, and they're going out into the wilderness. And so David's in exile again, kind of like what happened when he was being chased by Saul. Only as opposed to him and a small band, this is pretty large. This is his own contingent of troops. These are his veterans. These are battle-hardened. And there are families that are with him as well. They're all leaving Jerusalem, partly to try to keep the peace, but partly because David's actually afraid here. And so it's interesting. He seems to know. Now, again, we don't get much in the text. If you read the commentaries, again, I brought my commentaries in. If you read the commentaries, it says they're not sure why David reacts this way. Is it because he knew how many people Absalom had? Is it because he didn't want to confront Absalom? Maybe he thought it was going to like wear itself out. It is his son after all, right? So maybe he's just saying, maybe this will burn itself out. I'm just going to leave for now. Let people see who he really is. And then we'll just kind of, you know, work it out from there. Or is he just reacting? We don't have that in the text. And so you can just, there's speculation here on what David's motivations are. But clearly, he wants to avoid this conflict. And that might be a hint of what's going on, because one of David's failures as a parent through this whole thing is his inability to discipline his kids. And so maybe that's what this is a little bit too. It's like, I'm not going to confront him. I'm going to leave, and maybe it'll work its way out. And so he just, for some reason, has that ability of disciplining. And we don't know. It could be because, again, he has his own moral failings and he feels unable. We talked about that last week. Maybe he's paralyzed by this kind of that inaction sort of thing. Or it's just because he's maybe just not that good of a parent. We don't know. I mean, he's got all these concubines and wives. He's managing a kingdom. Maybe he's just a bad dad. It could be. It could be that simple. And so, but he leaves. Okay. Now, after he leaves, let's keep going. Does anybody have a comment on that? Before I want to stop, let people talk if they want to talk. Yeah, Ross, go ahead.
Do you have the direction that they're leaving wilderness is towards the
west. East or the west? Yeah, wilderness is the west. East is the enemy kingdoms. Yeah, so east is towards the, and I can show you a map later. East is when you end up in places like Moab and Ammon, right? If you go, right? So you want to go, right, where, that way, by your perspective, that way, right? So anyways, yeah. So he doesn't go. I mean, there is some that you can go to, but then he's going to be in foreign lands, although they all earn tribute anyway. So I guess he might've been safe there. anyways, we'll keep going. We are in 24. So, and Abathar came up, and behold, Zadok came also with all the Levites. So these are like your priests, right? The priestly caste, and they're the upper level of the priestly caste, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. So they're actually bringing the ark with David because he's the rightful king. So these priests are actually doing the right thing. And they set down the ark of God until the people had all passed out of the city. Then the king said to Zadok, carry the ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place. But if he says, I had no pleasure in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me what seems good to him. The king also said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? Go back to the city in peace with your two sons, Ahimaaz your son, and Jonathan, the son of Abathar. See, I will wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. So Zadok and Abiathar carried the Ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. They're actually going to act as, we're going to see later, as David's informants. But they're also there to guard the Ark of the Covenant. And David's basically saying, look, if God wants me back, I'm going to come back. It's his will. I'll let him take care of it. So even in the midst of David's sin and some of this being, he's reaping what he's sown a little bit. He's still showing that man of faith thing. This is why he's called a man after God's own heart, that in spite of his failings, he still has that trust relationship with God. Okay. So David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives. And that's interesting. Mount of Olives, right? Here we go. Weeping as he went, barefoot and with his head covered. And all the people who were with him covered their heads, and they went up weeping as they went. And it was told David, now this is an important name, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, please turn the counsel of, Ahithophel, there we go, Ahithophel, into foolishness. Now, this person's interesting. This is Bathsheba's granddad. And we know this from doing genealogies from Chronicles and other places. And so if you read study guides, or if you read study Bibles, or in this case, commentaries, this individual is Bathsheba's granddad. He acts as a counselor to the king, but he almost certainly is trying to like take out some revenge or some comeuppance on David. And so he's going to join the rebellion and be an advisor now for Absalom. And so David prays to God that his counsel would not work, or that it'd be turned into foolishness, or that it would create problems. Okay, but this is one of that family members. So he's probably trying to get back at David for how David basically, you know, stole a wife, his own granddaughter, and then got his own grandson-in-law killed. Okay, so there's probably some of that kind of blood feud revenge stuff going on that often happens in the ancient Near East here. So if you don't know that, that's who this figure is. Well, David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, and behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat torn and dirt on his head. It's a symbol of mourning. Okay. He's debasing himself. David said to him, if you go on with me, you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so now I will be your servant. Then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. Are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Behold, their two sons are with them there, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son, and by them you shall send to me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. Okay, so now we get a little bit of what David's doing here. David knows that Absalom is a political greenhorn. Think about it. Has Absalom any experience with governing? Does Absalom know all the factions in the court? Does Absalom know all the different politics and the foreign relations that are there and all the dignitaries? And you see what I'm saying? He has no clue what's going on. He just thinks he's going to be king because he's so great and he's so prideful. He looks good and he's mighty and he's younger than David. And he actually executed justice on his half-brother who had despoiled his sister. He's like, I'm a better king than David. I've made all these political campaign promises. So here's what, he's a political and leadership greenhorn. And so here's David leaving saying, all right, I need you two priests to stay here. Just stay here for a while. Tell me what's going on and make sure you watch over the ark. Hushai, now, if you come with me, this is going to be a problem. But if you stay here, I got a job for you. You see what he's doing? So David's wily, and he knows how to play the political game a little bit. And so he knows, and he also knows his son a little bit. And so he's using his, you know, political and leadership qualities to have an ear and also frustrate Absalom's counsel. So this is kind of like for you know, what we would say in the, I'm sure people that have been in the military, this is like counterintelligence, right? He's got agents, right, that are embedded. They're embedded with the, but the enemy thinks they're on his side, right? And by the way, speaking of Israel, this is Israel. Israel's Mossad, they do this like better than anybody. Right? In places like Iran or in Palestine or in Egypt or in all these other places, people don't even know they're part of Mossad. Okay. So as far as things, so this is that sort of thing. You got to get them to think you're on their side. So this is David's embedding these spies and getting a trust relationship with his spies with Absalom. This gets even more complicated next. Here we go. When David had passed, chapter 16, when David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him. Now, Mephibosheth, remember this character, is the lame son of Saul that David, Jonathan, Jonathan's son. That's my fault. That's in 2 Samuel 9. It's that little interlude that we did about a month ago. So he's Jonathan's son. There we go. And David said, because of my love with Jonathan, I'm going to have you live in my house and eat at the king's table. Ziba was kind of like a family servant in Saul's family and was managing the estate. And we see that in 2 Samuel 9. So this is the same character, Ziba. So Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" Ziba answered, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on. The bread and summer fruit are for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink." And the king said, "And where is your master's son?" Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem, for he said, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father.'" Then the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." And Ziba said, "I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king." Okay, Ziba here. So what's going on? Ziba, this is, so if you read the commentaries, and you might have study Bibles in front of you. Depending on who you talk to, going all the way back to the church fathers, like John Chrysostom, Ziba is in this for himself, and he's trying to manipulate the situation for personal gain. So in other words, he's saying, all right, I'm going to get in the king's favor, and I'm going to tell him this story about Mephibosheth, who he's treated well, and that Mephibosheth has betrayed him and kind of joined in this rebellion, thinking that eventually he's going to become king after Saul, as one of Saul's descendants and his son and Jonathan's descendants, right? And so Ziba's using David's sense of vulnerability here by trying to act like he's his friend, saying, "Hey, I'm going to outfit your army here. I'm going to outfit your young men. I'm going to give the king's household, including the women with you and the kids, I'm going to give you some donkeys to ride on." Because remember, he's managing Saul's household. So he's got some wealth, right? He's got access to wealth. And so he's going to treat David this way. And then, and the reason being so that David will then, as king and as judge, once he's restored, give the estate to Ziba and not Mephibosheth. So he's weaseling his way into David's good graces, if that makes sense, while David is leaving. That helps you. Okay, so all this stuff interconnects. It's just all these names get complicated. So it's hard to, sometimes you got to remember this stuff. But going back, and so if you read this commentary again, or if you look, and maybe you, some of you might have the study Bible in front of you too, but people are debating what his motives are. But going all the way back to the early church, most people think his motives are negative, and that he's trying to kind of take over the estate. That's the implication. Okay, now we have Shimei cursing David here. When King David came to Bahurim, and then came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, as he came, he cursed continuously. And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David and all the people and all the mighty men who were on his right hand and on his left. And Shimei said as he cursed, get out, you man of blood, you worthless man. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood." People back then and still in the Middle East are very vocal and very symbolic in the way they act. I don't know if you remember this, but when Saddam Hussein was removed from power in 2003, do you remember what all the people did with his pictures? They took their shoes and like started stomping on his image. Did you know? Do you remember this? It was all over the news. And then also when they were mad at President Bush, they threw a shoe at him, right? And he kind of ducks. Remember that whole thing? And so that was, and so that symbolism. So in the Iraqi Arab culture, the idea of symbolically stomping your shoe on somebody was like a way of disgracing them and making them feel low. This is a cousin culture, right? The Semitic peoples, these are cousin cultures. And so here we're going back over 3,000 years and it's very similar. So in this case, it's vocal cursing and then also throwing stones, throwing rocks, showing him, trying to shame them is what this is. Okay, he's trying to shame him. So then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head." But the king said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? He is cursing because the Lord has said to him, 'Curse David.' Who then shall say, 'Why have you done so?'" And David said to Abishai and all to his servants, "Behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjamite? Leave him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today." So David and his men went on the road, while Shimei went along on the hillside opposite him and cursed him as he went and threw stones at him and flung dust. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary at the Jordan, and there he refreshed himself. Kind of an odd story, right? Just kind of in the middle of this. But it's showing you the, both the good and bad sides of David here. The good side is David is a bit benevolent. He's not quick, right, to rush out and go attack this guy. He doesn't say, yep, you're right. He's disgracing me as a king. Yep, off with his head. He says, look, maybe God's wanting me to feel this shame right now. Maybe I've earned this. Maybe it's something. It's like, look, my own son's rebelling against me right now. This is the least of my problems. Just let him have his day. And if God wants him to do it, I'm going to take it. See ya. Right. That sort of thing. Let's just keep going. And so it shows David kind of at his best still, even in spite of this. He's wizened over his years, right? This is years after Bathsheba, years after some of the other things he's lived through. And so he's like, look, small potatoes, not dealing with this. And if God's having him do this, let God let him tell him to do this, to curse me or whatever. Maybe this is what I need. And so it's kind of interesting to see David's benevolence there. And then here comes Absalom. Now Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel, Bathsheba's granddad, remember that, with him. And when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, Hushai said to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. I want you to pay really close attention to what Hushai says here. It's pretty funny. And Absalom said to Hushai, is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend? And Hushai said to Absalom, no, for whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his I will be, and with him I will remain. And again, whom should I serve? Should I not be his son? As I have served your father, so I will serve you. That's really sneaky. Notice he never names him by name. And he just says, I'm going to long live the king. So he can say that faithfully. Long live the king. Okay. And then, right, who the Lord and the people have chosen, his I will be, and with him I will remain. So Absalom has no clue because he thinks he's talking about him. But really, Hushai is talking about David. So it's kind of deceptive and lying. Remember, I think it was last semester, we talked about virtue ethics, right? And the virtue about like bearing false witness and that sort of thing, on how in the book of Samuel, this is an example where God actually, or in this case, deception is sort of praised or at least shown in a positive light. That sort of thing. We talked about that. Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, I do not have Hebrew lips. Okay. Give your counsel. What shall we do? And Ahithophel said to Absalom, go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench to your father, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof. And Absalom went into his father's concubines and in sight of all of Israel. Now, of course, this is incestuous and this is awful. Okay. But that's kind of the point. Okay. That now in those days, the counsel that Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted the word of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed both by David and by Absalom. So at the time leading up to this event, he was considered kind of a golden tongue. He was considered really, really good, really wise in his advice, but now he's gone too far. Okay, now he's gone too far. But again, now here's the thing. If he is this is speculation. If he is Bathsheba's grandson, this could be the very same roof that David spied Bathsheba from. Think about it. So this is high, and remember, these are very public sins, right? People knew about this. Certainly by now, the vast majority of people in the know what happened with David and Bathsheba. So Ahithophel might be overreaching here for a variety of reasons. One of them could be revenge. Okay. So just something to keep in mind. It's like, yeah, remember what he did to my granddaughter? Yeah, let's go. I'm going to have Absalom do his own son, his own concubines. I'm going to disgrace this house as far as I can get here. But it's also going to create even more contention between father and son and make it so it'd be almost impossible for them, at least publicly, to reconcile. And so there's a political reason for this, but there's also probably a revenge motive here. With Ahithophel. Okay. And it goes without saying, this is a very public culture. The idea of like privacy, it didn't exist back then. That's another thing you should know. Really up until the 1800s, the idea that everybody lived in their own kind of like small little nuclear family units was really not a thing. Most people had their elderly living with them, often cousins, uncles, aunts, especially since the mortality rate was much higher, right? Even in Western Civ up until the 1700s or 1800s, really. Okay. And so when it came to issues like this, you didn't really, you know, my son's sitting over here and he can hear this. I was like, you didn't have to quote unquote have the talk with your kids because everybody kind of knew. because there was no such thing as privacy. Do you get what I'm saying? It just was, it wasn't. And in fact, if you read the Luther biography by Eric Metaxas, when Luther gets married, he actually has to have a designated friend to make sure and observe and sign off as a witness that the marriage was consummated. I'm not joking about that. It's actually in the Luther Bible, if you want to read about that. The only reason I bring that up right now is just to say that it's like, how do they know this? Why, you know, why are these private sins or like, what it's that it was very, everything about this is public. Even if it wasn't all observed, it was public. People knew stuff. They saw stuff. They knew what was going on. This idea of privacy that we assume is really kind of a modern invention. If that kind of helps, like, because it's kind of a weird statement. Why on the roof? Why attend? What is it? That's why. This was not an uncommon thing. Okay. It's also like how is, like, even in the, you know, now granted, it's the textual provenance of it in the Bible is a little spurious, meaning that Jonathan, Pastor Dinger will never preach on it. But the woman caught in adultery in John, right? It's like, how was she caught in adultery? If, you know, it's private. I mean, it's like, no. People knew everybody's business back then. It was everybody knew everybody's business. It wasn't just individual sin. There was a social contract that everybody kind of shared as far as this goes. Okay. Yeah. I don't need the run of the time. Here we go. We're about done anyways in about 10 minutes. Moreover, let's keep going here. Ahithophel said to Absalom, let me choose 12,000 men and I will arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and discouraged and throw him into a panic, and all the people who are with him will flee. I will strike down only the king, and I will bring back all the people back to you as a bride comes to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace. And the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and all the elders of Israel. Now, this advice from a military standpoint is actually probably pretty good. David's, you know, he's refreshing himself, but they're weary from the journey. Let's strike now. And it's only one dude. If we can kill David, the people are going to scatter because their leader's gone. And then you're going to be king, Absalom. This is my advice, right? So in this case, this part of the advice might be good. Then Absalom said, call Hushai the Archite also. That's David's agent, remember? And also let us hear what he has to say. And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said to him, thus has Ahithophel spoken. Shall we do as he says? If not, you speak. Then Hushai said to Absalom, this time the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good. Hushai said, you know that your father and his men are mighty men, and that they are enraged, like a bear robbed from her cubs in the field. Besides, your father is an expert in war. Now that's true. He will not spend the night with the people. Behold, even now he has hidden himself in one of the pits or in some other place. I mean, David knows where all the hiding places are, doesn't he? He knows where everything is, okay? And as soon as some of the people fall at the first attack, whoever hears it will say, there has been a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom. Then even the valiant men, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will utterly melt with fear. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and that those who are with him are valiant men. But my counsel is that all Israel be gathered to you, from Dan to Beersheba, as the sand by the sea for the multitude, and that you go to battle in person. So shall we come upon him in some place where he is to be found, and we shall light upon him as the dew falls on the ground. And of him, and with all the men with him, not one will be left. If he withdraws into the city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the valley until not even a pebble is to be found there. And Absalom said to all the men of Israel, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord has ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. This is a brilliant move. So what Hushai is doing is playing for time to give David time, right? And then what Hushai says is, hey, you know, yes, you may be ready now and you might want to strike when the iron's hot. That's what Ahithophel's saying, right? But you're talking about like the best of the best. Your dad is a military genius. All the people around him are veterans of war. If the battle goes incorrectly, you might lose everything. What you need to do instead is gather all of Israel's army from Dan to Beersheba, from north to the south, gather the entire army, and then with overwhelming force, go and establish yourself as king. So number one, Hushai does not look like he's a bad guy here. It looks like he's actually defending Absalom. Think about it. And saying, hey, Absalom thinks it's for his own best interest. In the meantime, Hushai is letting David plot, set the battleground, get all the strategy together, figure out what he wants to do. You see what I'm saying? This is brilliant by Hushai. Okay, this is awesome agent work, because Absalom thinks he's his friend, but Hushai is actually buying David time. It's pretty neat to actually see how this kind of unfolds. All right, Then Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, thus and so did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus so have I counseled. Now, therefore, send quickly and tell David, do not stay tonight at the fords of the wilderness, but by all means pass over, lest the king and all the people who are with him be swallowed up. Now, Jonathan and Ahimaaz, those are the priest kids, okay, were waiting at Enrogel. A female servant was to go and tell them, and they were to go and tell King David, for they were not to be seen entering the city. But a young man saw them and told Absalom. So both of them went away quickly and came to the house of a man at Beruim who had a well in his courtyard. And they went down into it. And the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and scattered grain on it, and nothing was known of it. When Absalom's servants came to the woman at the house, they said, where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan? And the woman said to them, they have gone over the brook of water. And when they sought and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. That's, again, deception here portrayed positively. Right? She's hiding spies, basically. After they had gone, the men came out of the well and went and told King David. They said to David, arise and go quickly over the water, for thus and so as Ahithophel counseled against you. Then David arose and all the people who were with him, and they crossed the Jordan. By daybreak, not one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. There's the direction, by the way, you're seeing this, for those of you who are asking directions. Okay. When Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey and went off home to his own city. He set his house in order and hanged himself, and he died and was buried in the tomb of his father. He realized that he was going to be out. And so he kind of thought this was the honorable way out, so to speak. So he basically, you know, falls on his own sword. Okay. And that's, again, that sad story of that house involving Bathsheba. That this keeps going. It doesn't stop. When Nathan the prophet said, the sword will never depart from your house after David's sin, he was not joking. Right. And this goes all over the place. Then David came to Mahanaim, there we go, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. Now Absalom had sent Amasa over the army instead of Joab. Amasa was the son of a man named Ithra the Ishmaelite, who had married Abigail, the daughter of Nasha, sister of Zariah, Joab's mother. And Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. You don't need to know who that is. I would never quiz you on that, of course. But the point is a lot of these people are cousins that are ruling on this. They're either second cousins or, you know, or that guy is my cousin, but because his dad married my aunt, or, you know, it's a lot of that sort of stuff. So they're kinship bonds, okay? So when David came to Mahanaim, Shobi the son of Nahash from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir the son of Amiel from Lodebar, and Barzillai the Gileadite from Roglim, brought beds, basins, and earthen vessels, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans, and lentils, honey and curds, and sheep and cheese from the herd for David and the people with him to eat. For they said, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. Hospitality. Okay. And this is still valued in the Near East, right? You go to a Muslim, even Muslim countries, if you're not a Muslim, and you go to a place like Egypt and they welcome you into their home, they'll treat you well because it's like considered part of their culture. And so that's actually something you should know. You may think that the religion is a problem, and it can be. But in terms of like that hospitality mindset in the Mediterranean world in general, that's a big thing. Arabs, Jews, even like the Greeks and the Italians also, hospitality is a big deal. If you read Greek mythology, Zeus guards the hospitality right. And he like even tests people with hospitality. And so this is highly valued. And so David's going to remember this. That's the reason these people are here. All right. Yes, we can finish Absalom here before I have to go preach. Okay, here we go. Then David mustered the men who were with him and sent him over commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. Here's David doing this. All right, we got this plan. We know what we're doing. David's a commander. He knows what he's doing. He's a general. And David sent out the army, one third under the command of Joab, one third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zariah, Joab's brother, and one third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. Ittai's the guy who was the foreigner that said, nope, remember that Ruth Moab thing? He proved his loyalty, okay? And the king said to the men, I myself will also go out with you. He learned his lesson. Remember that with Bathsheba? He doesn't go out, right? But the men this time said, you shall not go out. For if we flee, they will not care about us. If half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it is better that you send us help from the city. The king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. Because really, this is a family dispute. His men realized this, okay? So the king stood at the side of the gate, and while all the army marched out by hundreds and by thousands, and the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, deal gently with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders about Absalom. It's going to be important later, by the way. So here's the king. He's supposed to be leader of Israel. He has a mortal enemy now. And yet he still can't bring himself, you get what I'm saying, to actually discipline his son. And on one hand, you sympathize because all fathers love their sons. And there's a tenderness here with David. But it also looks like weakness to his commanders. And so his command, think about if you were one of his commanders, one of the military men, what are we fighting for? Right? That's going to show up a little bit later. Okay. So the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the loss there was great on that day, 20,000 men. The battle spread over all the face of the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. Interesting. So it almost sounds like, you know, it's like Lord of the Rings and the Ents. You know, they show up and they kind of, we're not exactly sure what that means, if it's wild animals or if it's because they get lost or maybe the terrain was hazardous, you know, and like they're falling off cliffs or.
If you have any questions or comments, email them to podcast@gracepocatello.org and make sure to subscribe to our channel to stay up to date on sermons and classes at Grace Lutheran Church in Pocatello, Idaho. This podcast is designed so that you can take Grace with you anywhere you go.